Hey everybody, welcome to Shop Talk Show number 261. It's a rapid fire episode, me and Dave getting at you with as much question on answer action as we possibly can. The way the questions in this one came out was that we just so happened to touch on a lot of the like classic unanswerable arguments in web design and development. One of them was like, what's up with Vim and Emacs versus other types of editors? What about learning abstractions before you learn the underlying library, like framework or vanilla first? What about like monitors? What makes for a good monitor? What about BEM? Isn't that like, is that make sense in the world? Oh my God, all those things coming up and more. Some stuff like, is your side hustle good or bad for your job prospects? That's kind of a fascinating one. This episode is brought to you in part by CodePen, specifically CodePen Teams. Check out codepen.io/pro/teams to learn how CodePen Teams can kind of work for your company or organization. And it's gotten a lot better recently, so worth checking that out. For now, Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopper Maniacs. You are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Coy.
That's
Chris.
Right. Just another show with me and you. Hopefully all y'all out there listening enjoy this kind of thing. But if you prefer it when we have amazing, super talented guests on, stay tuned because we just lined up a bunch of those shows coming up in the future.
Yeah. And guess what, Chris? We were talking before the show. I committed the cardinal sin. I created my own HTML slide deck framework.
Oh, that's great. I have showed it to me, so I won't pretend to not have seen it. But yeah, it's deliciously simple. I think it's one of those moments where I'm gonna watch it with fascination because I've seen what you've done here, and it's just like an index.html file with like section in it, and you know, a little lightweight JavaScript to watch for, you know, some kind of JavaScript event that changes the slides, and a little bit of light CSS to fade them in and out and stuff. What my favorite part about it is it's got like a lot of this like VW object fit type of stuff going on. So like, it doesn't matter the size and or aspect ratio of the screen, but what's going to happen, you know, like then you're like, maybe I'll break these slides up or maybe I need a little, you know, like it'll, as you evolve, I wonder if it will become a big old framework.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking about like web components. I'm thinking about, you know, it's sort of based on Hakim El-Hattab's Slides.js, which is amazing.
Isn't it Reveal.js or does he, is that
or one? Or Reveal.js. And then, sorry, he owns like slides.com. That's like the business end of it, which is also great. But I was like, I wanted a full screen iframe, and that's either like a pro feature or something. And I just was like, I'm going to make my own, which is fine. I think like there's a lot of work on UIs and stuff in that app. And I think people need that. For me, I was just like, I'm going to code it. And it's been interesting. I made like when you open Chrome and you have, the devices, a responsive device thing, and you can put it in a phone. I made like an HDTV. So I was like a 1080p screen. So I'm kind of like testing screen sizes too. So if you have ever been caught in the 4x3 or 16x9 trap as a speaker, I've figured out a workaround, at least to like test it out. So, but yeah,
in yours, it doesn't matter because it's just, it's a background image that floods the page. So hopefully it's like, you don't need hyper accuracy because they're right. It's willing to do some cropping and stuff here and there.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some images that are like messed up, but I realized, or I learned, or I inspected, you can like set, like max width 50 VW or something. So you're just saying like, hey, this image is only like inline style, that this image should only be like 50% of the screen. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's cool. There's different object fit properties. If you had one particular image that absolutely had to be contained within there, that's why there's keywords for those things.
Well, and I'm using a lot of object fit contain because it's
instead of
that's
cover.
Like cover, because cover like bleeds it out, and that would actually be a cool effect in some areas, but contain is the jam, because it's just like, don't break the page, don't add a scroll bar, dude. So that's kind of the whole goal of that. And then Flexbox is working in there too. I could probably use grid, but Flexbox is working.
Nice.
And I've got a little bit of grid, you know, for like those slides where you want to do like three columns and stuff like that. The only thing I don't have yet is like the build animations, you know, like where you like list item one, list item two, listen, but I'll probably do that. So I don't know. Keep an eye. If it doesn't crash and burn, like on launch this Friday, I guess, because we're recording this a week out. But if it doesn't crash and burn, I'll be pretty happy with it. So I might release it.
I mean, there is all kinds of advantages to it, right? It's a URL, so you can send it to people super easily. You can send people to individual slides. They can search through your slides. There's accessibility that it gets inherently that's nice. I mean, there's a lot of advantages to it, I think.
I've already thought out the notes, and I just was like, oh, you could just have like P class notes, you know, and then you hit control P, all the slide styling disappears. And then, you know, and then maybe even the images disappear, and you just basically get like a screenplay of how the whole thing works. And
my coworker Jake once made, I think he used Live View ultimately for the slide, so he could have it open in two places. But, you know, he'd hit control P or whatever, like you're describing, on one screen. So it shows them, but not on the other screen. But then he hooked up like a web worker kind of thing, or a web socket, I meant to say. So like when he hit forward on either machine that had it open, it would sync the what slide he's on. But the view still looked different. So like, that would be about the world's simplest web socket to open. So could try that.
All right. Well. Jake always raising the bar. But
you know what I also makes me think of, just while we open the show with like random things we're thinking of. So there's, you know, let's say there's a background image. I think you're using, there's two different probably types of images you're using. One of them is a background image, which is just like, I don't know, flood the background with whatever, because it's just a...
Yeah, background size cover.
Sure. Basically. And then there's like, this is an image that's part of the content of the slide, so don't mess with this one, like IMG.
Yeah.
Sure. So there's two different kinds there. And then, so like, let's say though... Like not in the context of your slide deck, just any old website in the world, you're using background image and you want to position it. So let's say you want to position, you know, by default, a background image is top left, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you can easily set keywords to be like, oh, I want you to start at the top right or bottom right or something. So that when you cut off, if in case there's too much, or even if you don't cut off, if it's smaller, then that's like the dot on the div that is like home base for that image.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty obvious stuff. But and so you can represent those in percentages as well. And background position, like 50% is right in the middle. Background position 0 is along the left. Background position 100% is the weird one, where it doesn't push it all the way out of view. It aligns the right edge of the image up to 100%, which is interesting in that, like, let's say you want to, I don't know, align an image a quarter of the way around. The math just is super bizarre.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, or like when you're like, pull it like negative 25 and then it just, I don't know.
You'd think it would be a quarter of the way, but it's not, because that's not how the math works out. It's very,
right.
Anyway, there's an article about it on CSS Tricks that I was like, wow, this really is mind bending. I don't disagree with the spec on how they did it, because I think right aligning something kind of makes more, is a bigger use case. But yeah, it makes anything in between other than 0, 50, and 100 very weird. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was enough mouth blogging stuff. Maybe we have a follow-up-ish question, because Ben Byford writes in here about monitors. So I'll just read what he wrote. I'm still using my MacBook Pro 2014. I'm a little envious, actually. When I opened up my MacBook Pro 2017, it didn't wake up this morning, and I was like, "Oh, great, cool, glad I upgraded." Anyway, the screen,
cool.
I guess I'll just hold this little button down to force quit it like I have 10,000 times. Okay, but I really want a new monitor. It seems like a minefield at the moment for different types of screens for work, resolutions, etc. DPI, 4K, 5K, etc., etc. I mainly work on web projects. Do you have any opinions on screens and maybe even having... one for high-end work and one worse monitor for low-end reference. I think that's a funny concept that I've never heard before. Like, I'm on purpose going to buy a crappy monitor to see how my websites look on crappy monitor.
A bad idea. But.
No. Okay, so whatever. Let's talk monitors for a second. What do you got right now? Are you liking it?
I have my LG 34-inch ultra-wide. 3,440 pixels by 1440 pixels. So, yeah.
So not.
I see all your websites very wide. It's embarrassing for you, but I've seen it. So, I love this ultra wide. I mostly just love like having a lot of windows in my face and not like not having a bezel, you know. So I really like this screen. It is like one.
So I had it too, because I'm mostly envious of you, and everybody I know is going with the ultra wides. And I can say the aspect ratio is pretty sweet. It's kind of like having two monitors next to each other, but you don't have to. That's what you mean by bezel, right? There's no bezel in the middle of two monitors.
Yeah. And so it's almost 4K in the number of pixels. So the amount of pixels I have here is just under 4K, but it's 1X. So if they ever came out with a 4K, I'd probably need like 10 graphics cards to like drive it, because it would just be so demanding on how to like do it. I do see now that LG has introduced a ultra wide 4K, but it probably runs at like 30 hertz. That's so there's another dimension here, is how many hertz does it run at? You know, is it 60 FPS or is it only max out at 30 FPS? Who knows?
There's limits, then, right? Because that's why, I mean, at one point Apple made a monitor and they have just stopped. They have since like teased that they're going to come back with a pro monitor thing, but everybody's like not super sure how it's going to work, right? Because the new MacBooks can't power like double 4Ks or whatever. I don't know what the deal is though, because I pulled the trigger. I had like a crappier version of what you have. I traded up for the LG one that they kind of mostly promote now. And I know this is pretty Mac specific.
The 4K one?
It's 5K, I think.
5K, okay, yeah.
And so it is, what I wanted was, I've never had this Retina on an external display. I've never had it. And I'm starting to just really need it and want it, because it's just was too weird that I'd like, you know, write one blog post with like weirdly low res images in it and one with high res, because my screenshots were just varied from day to day, whether I was on which screen I was on. And I was just like, you know what? It's a Retina world or whatever. I hate seeing Retina. We should just say like high resolution, right? I mean, Retina is just like a weird Apple word that anyway, I have it. And what it's not even the 5K that was the major selling point for me, although that was a big part of it. One of them is that it has a built-in camera, so no longer do I have to like schlep a cord down the back of my monitor with this like weird crappy Logitech thing that I clip to the top of it that's always falling down. One of them is that it's a hub too, so there's a whole bunch of ports on the back of it, so I don't need to have another USB hub sitting around. It is the USB hub. And it is powered. So when I come home and plug into it, I plug one thing into my MacBook. It's just...
That's beautiful.
You plug it in and it's the hub, it's the power, and it's the connection to the monitor. It's all of those things. And I was like, oh, that's so awesome. I'm getting it.
I do like that. I would enjoy that on laptoping. So,
did you pull the trigger on a new laptop, or should we save that for another...
Oh, there's some updates there, folks, but we'll figure it out. I was going to a client meeting and I plugged in my Surface Pro 3, which is amazing. And, it didn't work. So it didn't charge. And I was like, And cause I have to like use this laptop on the airplane into the client's office. So, and then I have talks coming up. I got it working. We're fine, but it was very like, it was like Easter weekend, stores are closed. I was just like, what do I do? And so anyway, some things are afoot there. I'll update y'all as on my laptop decisions as things progress. But yeah, anyway, so back to screens, there's, you know, there's also like that 4K, but then there's this new thing, color gamuts, like UHD. I'm sure you've probably seen that on the TV market,
right?
But like this ultra wide color gamut thing, which is weird because I feel like monitors displays just got up to the like 99% Adobe sRGB or whatever, but now there's like a new color gamut coming in. And I think A Book Apart is got a book from, is it Craig Hockenberry who's doing it, but about coming up about like color gamuts. The new iPads have this ultra wide color gamut, or ultra.
They just look good. I can't say I did look for a new TV somewhat recently, and you look at a lot of TVs and it's, I don't know. I feel I'm definitely entering the old person territory. I'm like, what is all this stuff? I mean, this stuff all used to make sense to me and now it's very confusing and I feel old. But if you look at ones that are at the like, that nobody actually buys, the ones that are like $15,000 TVs, mm-hmm. and they make blacks that are like crazy, super midnight, super black, and it looks amazing.
Yeah.
What is
imagine
that?
Blacks blacker than you've ever seen in your whole life. It's amazing. But like, so these are coming out, and that's like for photography, it's like amazing. You're just getting more detail, more real color, more like real world vibrancy.
Yeah, you'll notice it looks good.
So. But it's, you know, is it like, do we have to start designing for it? I feel like for me, it's like, is that just our, I guess to answer Ben's question, get the monitor you want. Like you're stuck with it for a few years, like a half a decade at least, you know, it's 5-10 years. So get the one you want. But like, what, you know, well, for web design, where do we target? I think that's the question I'm struggling with, or whatever, is like, where do we target? I don't think it, this is conservative me, I don't think it's smart to just like build for these ultra high end Apple devices, you know, or these like, you know, $2,000 displays, you know. I don't think most people have that, you know. I think but you know, I say that, and then next year it's like Dell's like, oh, by the way, all these are going to ship with a 4K Ultra HD, you know? And it's like, oh, geez. Thanks, Dell. You just made my life a lot harder. So I don't know.
I don't know. Buy the monitor that you want.
Like, between my laptop and my desktop, and then I have like an old cinema display on my wife's computer in the kitchen, you know, like I'm using a lot of different displays, but I'm really not using a lot of 4K. I'm kind of in the 1.5K or whatever that's called, like the 1.5 DPI. So yeah, I don't know. Not quite Retina Man yet, but
all right. So we have no advice is the point. Like, just buy the monitor you want here. It's like the point you brought up about buying a crappy monitor is kind of interesting. It depends on if you'd actually use it for that or not, or if it would just sit there and gather dust or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you could always like do the dual display, like one out to the side. But, you know, if you're like with the Mac laptop, you actually, that 2014 laptop, you might need to check and make sure it can actually throw out a 4K signal, because the graphics card might not be enough. So you might be limited to something like a sub 4K computer.
The LG display stuff has been treating us well, so maybe we'll leave that as the recommendation.
Yeah, these LG displays are pretty good right now. So anyway, Dell's also look nice, but all right. I didn't even talk about hertz and refresh rates, because I do gaming now, Chris. I have a gaming keyboard. I'm using gaming and a gaming mouse. Yeah. It has LEDs. It's set to Miami right now, so I'm feeling it.
Like a hot pink switch?
A hot pink and teal, and it's just pulsing Miami. It's great. And it's wonderful. And I guess like refresh rates are another thing too. Like how many FPS can you get out of that thing? that's a big deal. So,
and I suppose isn't there, I bet there's trickery involved too, you know, like, look at this monitor. It's amazing. It has the most pixels ever. And you're like, wow, I'm a consumer and I am buying this message of how many pixels it has. And I buy into it thinking I'm getting this great monitor. What I don't realize is that they've cheaped out on some other areas or something like refresh rate.
Right. Yeah. Like there's some really cool, like, you know, panels, but then, yeah, you like might only get 30 Hertz. And so every website with an animation you go to is just going to go check, check, check.
I could see making that mistake and just, and being confused and not even knowing what happened.
Oh, I would certainly not know. But if you're looking for a cheap here's back to cheap displays, go to like Best Buy. There's Dells for like $100, $200. So you can get like a little 24 inch display, pretty good. So get that. There you go. I've done that before. And then I dropped it, taking it to my mom's house. I was like loading it up in the car and dropped it on the concrete. And, and I was like, sorry, mom. Guess you don't.
Let's just pretend that monitor was $200 instead of $100.
Yeah. All right. Next question. We're on question two here, Chris. Here we go. Brian Gilbraith writes in with a holy war. Here we go. I see a lot of talk regarding text editor preference. I use Atom as it was recommended to me when I started, and I like it because of the packages. That being said, I always hear about Vim and Emacs and the hardcore community who loves them and wouldn't use anything else. So what's the deal? Why is there such a hardcore community, and what do they offer that I'm missing? Thanks for the show. Keep up the work. Thanks, Brian.
I have so little to say. Like, I find this actually quite an interesting argument, but I don't die on the sword of any particular one of these things. My coworker Tim Savitt is like just a Vim lover and does that because he's in and out of so many different servers all the time, and that's the big as far as I know, the big like plus one for Vim is that it's kind of just built in to the command line. So imagine you're sitting there on the command line. You know, even if y'all out there hardly ever work in the command line, you know what it is, right? It's a little blinking cursor, and you can type like PB copy squiggly line / file dot text or whatever, and it executes commands and it just does stuff. What not everybody knows is that you can type like vim space file dot text and it will like open up this weird like simulated text editor right in the command line, and you can edit files in there. And it always seemed like, you know, when I first saw it ever in my lifetime, I was like, wow, this is an interesting, like, I don't know, like Nintendo looking hack thing just to make editing files possible through the command line. It was never intended to be a great experience. It's just nice that you can do this with some kind of UI and save the file. Like, how cool that somebody invented this weird little hack. That's not what it is at all. I don't think it's regarded by the Vim community as a weird little hack. That's just how I felt about it at the time. It's actually like this, the idea that there's different modes that you're in and that you can use the arrow keys to hammer around, and there's a million different key commands to do different things in there. It isn't just a weird little hack. It's like the way a lot of people really prefer to interact with text files.
Yeah. I mean, it's a whatever 30-year-old text editor. It's pretty good if it's still around and in use and installed. You know, there is like a holy war between Vim and Emacs. Emacs is similar
in the way that it's Vim. A command line thing, right?
Yeah. It's basically, you know, I'm like, and see, this is where it's a little confusing. You go to like the gnu.org Emacs, you know, and they like show like an app. But I'm pretty sure that's just a GUI that somebody has built around the app. But, so Emacs is good. But I don't actually know, like, I couldn't
articulate.
And this is maybe where we need to. Yeah, I can't be like, here's the five killer features of Emacs and why you'd want to switch. I think it maybe is sort of more like you don't have to like bounce out to like build software and stuff like that. You can do that all in there. But you know, a lot of hardcore command line users will use like NerdTree or Tmux, which is an app to like split your terminal into like two screens or four screens, you know, yeah. Like, so like they have like these And then there's like a whatever, you like mash some claw key command to like switch between each terminal window or whatever. And so, or terminal pane inside one window. And so you like set it up how you like it. And I think that's the thing. I think that's the thing people like about it. I mean, you download code or Atom, and you get GitHub or Microsoft Visual Studios UI that they've decided, you know, with Vim and these command line tools and like Tmux and Nerdtree and all these things, you can kind of like construct how you want it. You know, you want the thing on the right, you put the file tree on the right, you throw it over to the right one. You don't have absolute control, I don't think, or it might not pay off to modify everything on the command line, but you do have a lot of control to kind of make it your thing. And that's, I think, what the thing is. You make a dot file, you just save like my development environment, and then you can load that up on any computer in the world or any Linux machine in the world, and now it obeys what you like.
Right.
And so it's kind of like you deploy your text editor to different computers. And, you know,
it's funny when you think about it, that feels so different to us. But then, let's compare it to something like Atom. Okay, Atom isn't like that at all, right? It's a native app, and you open it and it's an executable on your computer, and it opens up and there's a sidebar of files and you can search things and there's keep commands, but you know, the way that it looks is customizable. The keyboard commands are customizable. It does just run on your computer, but it can run on any computer because it has versions that run pretty much anywhere. It's like, and these configurations are saved in JSON, so you could commit them and deploy them to other computers too. And it's like, when you zoom out a little bit, it's like they're not really that different. And Vim has apps that run like Atom does too, and Emacs does too. So it's like there's a lot of gray area between these things.
To some degree, it's just a pissing contest. It's like, my thing's the better thing, you know? But I think it's also this thing of like, people like their editor. They're very invested in how productive it makes them feel. So I think it's natural for humans like me and you to be like, I use this thing, you're going to love it. You know, I use CodePen all the time, you're going to love it. That's maybe not true. You know, CodePen's the exception, right? But everyone's going to love it. But like, you know, your perception, you know, you think it's the best because you only use the best, you know, and it just, I don't know. It's like a Coke versus Pepsi thing. It's like, sure, Coke's the best, and you're weird if you drink Pepsi, but like, it's cool that people drink Pepsi. Did I come?
Yeah,
I did.
Yep. Yeah. That's what it is. It is funny that switching is so, it can be so incredibly difficult thing to do. If you know, if we were to come down a different way on this and tell the whole world they should use Vim, and I really think it's probably not a bad choice. I think you'd be smart to do that if you were choosing for the first time. But anyway, like just the other day, one of my command key stopped working on my keyboard for some weird reason. It took me a while to figure out what was going on, but I had work to do like right now. I didn't have time to screw around with it. And I was shocked at how much it affected my productivity. It was one key on the keyboard and I was like, at half capacity of productivity. It reminded
you're like
me
crippled.
How,
you're just like,
how many things can go wrong
in your office?
Yeah. And that's the tiniest thing of literally a million things. That anyway, good luck, Brian. You can't really make a wrong choice there. I think Adam's a perfectly nice editor. And if you want to switch, I would read more about it and just give it a shot because trying new things is good for you no matter what.
Hey everybody, this episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by CodePen, and specifically CodePen Teams. So Teams is a special way that you can use CodePen collaboratively. So maybe you have a team of 10 people, and when you're using CodePen as the team, all of you can access all the same pens and projects and collections and work together on things. You all have pro access to CodePen, and you're all billed together for that thing. So let's say you've been using CodePen as an individual person for years. And you have yourself on there and your whole, all your pens and projects and all that stuff. That doesn't have to change. You can still use CodePen as an individual person and be on a team. The team invites you to join, and you can use CodePen either way. It's called context switching, and you just easily, you know, click a link and switch back and forth between using CodePen as a team and using CodePen as yourself. So it's kind of cool. As soon as, you know, you're on a team, and you can upgrade your account to a team account at any time if you want. Your personal account stays the way it is. The owner of that team invites individual users. And then those individual users, including yourself, can stop paying for Pro individually because the team has this shared billing. Everybody who's a part of that team just gets CodePen Pro automatically. Both the team is Pro, and you can have, the, you know, the team has Pro level access, and all the individual members of them have Pro access as well. So that's how it works. Collaborative editing, you get all the Pro features and stuff, but you're using CodePen as a team too. It's very cool.
Mr. Chris Colvin writes in, with another just flame debate that there's absolutely unanswerable.
Welcome to the flame talk show. Yeah,
well, I was just at a conference and did a little Q&A, and this is one of the first questions I got to. I'm struggling to get good at learning JavaScript and came across someone saying it's better to learn a framework first, then deal with understanding vanilla JS. And when we say vanilla, I think most people understand that, but that means JavaScript, just native JavaScript, the JavaScript that runs right in a browser. No frameworks, no libraries, no nothing. Do you agree, or is it best to get a full understanding of vanilla JavaScript before moving on to a framework? So, you know, can't you imagine, Dave, someone out there saying, you better not use a framework. Don't you dare. You should have an understanding of the fundamentals before you get into under abstractions. Otherwise, how do you even know what you're abstracting? Everybody's heard that argument, and everybody's heard this argument too, the one that's like, you know, if you get into it with an abstraction first, it makes you productive, it makes you happier, and there's no reason that you can't go backwards and learn a little bit about what's happening behind the scenes. So that's what I mean by this being unanswerable, is that there is no right answer here. There's no better answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to who you are as a person. Do you like to just kind of make progress, or do you want to learn everything about it before you jump in? You know, are you a person who's like, ignorance is bliss? When I travel, I just like go and I have fun. Or are you the type of person who like travels and like plans out every, you know, you print out an itinerary, you have like a spreadsheet of where to go. You know, I think that's, it's very similar here. I just want to like scream, just like stop the like framework versus vanilla thing. Cause it's fine, but it's just so like, there's so many reasons you'd want to use a framework and you'd find benefits there. I think it's silly. That said, I think there are people who just prefer to write their own. We opened the show. I wrote my own slide framework. Why did I do that? I don't know. But now I have a full understanding of how my slide deck works, you know?
Yeah, which you can't argue there's some advantages to that, understanding the kind of low-level nature that's going on. And then, you know, the argument can continue, though, Dave. It's not like you wrote JavaScript. You know, you could have also wrote a browser to run your slide deck in, but you didn't, right? You stopped short of writing a browser, right? All this stuff is abstraction sitting on abstractions that is many levels deep, all the way down to ones and zeros. So, you know, your abstraction isn't better than someone else's necessarily. My metaphor for this, which I've probably said many times on this show, and it probably isn't my metaphor. I'm sure I heard it from someone smarter than me, but it's so generic that it works for anything. Is the music one, is the piano or guitar or whatever, in that, if you get one of those, there's some expectation that you have to practice it and learn about it in order to get good at it. And if your teacher said, don't you dare look up the tab to that Merle Haggard song that you want to play on it. We're doing, you know, theory and scales for 18 months, and then you can do that. No, you go home and you look up the tab for the Merle Haggard song and you play it because that's fun and it makes sure that you're going to get through those 18 months. Whereas if somebody told you can only play scales for 18 months, you'd probably set the thing down and be like, you know what, I'm good.
Hey, you're probably more popular at a party if you can play a Merle Haggard song as opposed to...
Yeah, and you're more popular at work scales. If you can get the job done rather than knowing how to get it done.
I think music is a good example. I mean, like, dude, you can spend a lot of time learning music theory, and it's actually great because, like, you pick up things, you like build an ear for music, you become a good musician. But like, to play the guitar, you just need one chord, and that's called a power chord, and you can play every song in existence using the power chord. And it's just basically you mash your two fingers on the guitar in the right way, and you can play any song in the world. Is that gonna, like, can you play, I don't know, like, is it gonna be as great as, I don't know, Yngwie Malmsteen? Probably not, but again, you're just playing. If your goal is to play, anyway, back to frameworks. If you want like a fully stateful, asynchronous application, and you're new to JavaScript, you probably want React or Vue, not coding it by yourself. So that would be my opinion. Although here's a counterpoint. Craig Ferdinandi runs a site called gomakethings.com. And we should maybe reach out to him, but he's doing a lot of talk about how to do X in vanilla JavaScript. And he has a vanilla JS guidebook, little course thing or book course, that you can get. This is a free promotion for him. But anyway, it's just he comes to mind as somebody who's kind of pushing this, like, go do things vanilla. So there you go. You'll get like a good, you know, example. Like, I guess you'll get like a very good feel for how to build things without JavaScript. So he's got plugins like a smooth scrolling thing, you know, modals, things like that. I don't know about the accessibility, but I'm sure that's easy or possible to shoehorn in if it's not there. So, all right, Chris.
Yeah, let's pick another one here. Wayne, I think, he's our next fellow. Wayne Thum. I want to create a website for a large family tree. I don't care what I write it in, but would like it to be responsive and fairly easy to add update people. The tree has enough forks/branches that I'm at a loss on how to display it on mobile. Any thoughts on what to use to display data that is mostly horizontal? Oh, that's funny that I would picture a family tree as being vertical, I guess, but it's skinny at the top and wide at the bottom, right? I mean, it depends on what's going on there. It's both horizontal and vertically large. One thing that comes into mind right away is that it's not the end of the world on, how do I phrase this the best way? Like, not putting the meta tag on a website can be kind of useful sometimes. And it's kind of magical what browsers choose to do in those scenarios. It kind of zooms out to just kind of display what's ever there. It actually does some pretty interesting magic to make that happen. And it doesn't stop you from pinch and zooming on things. So pinch and zoom is a pretty decent UX pattern. So like, I wouldn't rule that out. Just like making a website that has a thing and not worrying too much about horizontal or vertical scrolling and just not using the meta tag, because then it's up to users to pinch and zoom, which users know how to pinch and zoom. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. Although it's not just to say that not all responsive patterns need to squish things horizontally until they fit. You know, that's not necessary for every single, you know, responsive pattern in the world. I don't know what else, though. There's the response, you know, there's how do you build this thing is one question. Then how do you make it responsive is another question.
Yeah. You know, it's tough. I mean, I don't know that there's a good expression in HTML for this. Like, how do you, you know, the sites I've seen, you know, I've actually used a site a decade ago, but genie.com, it kind of does this like family tree thing. But it's like, it was like a flash app or something like that. So you basically like, you make a canvas or a map, almost like Google Maps, you know, it's just these things arrayed. And then you have a zoomer that zooms in and out. I guess that could also be on mouse wheel, but you have a thing that zooms in and out of this canvas. And so, or SVG you could use too, to have like elements be clickable and things like that. And then,
yeah, SVG, you know, seems like a good choice, doesn't it?
Yeah, so like you'd like in your devs block, you'd probably just use like you'd probably put some modules like a card or something, you know, like a person card, and person card could have images if they wanted and details, birth date, you know, death date, because that's a thing on a family tree. And then you just kind of somehow templatize that and keep injecting, you know, nodes into the tree. Now the arrangement is tough, and then you have to like draw lines between. So you're going to have to like, for every node, you'll have to know what type of connection. Is it a marriage? Is it a divorce? Is it, you know, like it gets complicated. I mean, my family tree is a hot mess because like my parents divorced. I have six stepbrothers total, you know, it's a hot mess. So like, what do you do? You know? And now all my stepbrothers have, wives and kids. And so it's just like, oh man, this is a mess.
How is there no family tree JS? That seems wild. There must be something.
Yeah, why is that not?
You can look on CodePen, and there's some decent examples actually. Like here's a pure CSS one that looks pretty cool.
What's tough though, it's even like from a data structure, it's hard to express like in JSON either. You know,
it's like, so nested. It's like no, there's, I can't imagine a good data structure that makes sense for it, because it's like as soon as you have one level, you're another level deep, you know?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It's not very clean. And so I think you almost just have this like people object, you know, persons, and then you say their connections, you know, like parent ID is their actual parent. And then what it, you know, this connections thing. And can I point to a weird CodePen I made? Cause keep CodePen weird. I made, you know, one of those like crazy people boards, like the government is watching you, red string boards, you know, you know what I'm talking about? Follow the money sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's you know, Inigo Montoya or whatever in the middle with lots of red lines to it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I made one of those with SVG. I've been thinking about how to make this for like years, and then I finally figured it out. Like you can like basically get like the position of elements, and then use like you can kind of like use some you can just overlay an SVG over the whole thing, or I'm underlaying, I guess, but like you overlay an SVG over everything, and like you can now connect. And the API I made was like all through the IDs, like data connections, and then it connects like Bill 1, it's all Bill Murray's, connects to Bill 2 and Bill 3, and Bill 2 connects to Bill 5 and Bill 6, and Bill 3, Bill 4 connects to Bill 3. And I, you know, it's just, for me, this was like, how do you express connections in HTML is a question I do not know the answer to. And this is my first attempt at it. Like, how do I
connect? Oh, I see. You did it with literally path elements. Yeah. So you figured out their coordinates and then built a little path syntax based on the like top left corner of the images that you found, or essentially.
Yep. And then I did a little like offset to give it the string a little bit of a swoop. You could rip that out. That's the Q thing, but the quadratic.
Right. And you could get fancier with that, and that like, okay, let's say it's much like deeper on the page. So first come out and then come back in. And you could get fancy with these, with the swoops if you wanted to.
Yeah. So it's going to be kind of cool. I don't know. I may or may not be thinking about building one of these for certain administrations and Russian connections. So we'll see how it goes. I'm just like, oh, I could visualize this like with HTML, you know, pretty simple HTML array. It could work on divs. It could work on, you know, images. So I'm not sure this solves your problem, but maybe it does. But I don't know, you know, maybe it's like you have a bunch of divs in grid elements or something. And then, cause this doesn't care where you connect, how you connect things. So, maybe you, I don't know. This is a tough problem. I'm not envious of trying to solve this, but, I think you can, you just need to kind of have some smart, you know, you'll probably want a grid and then lay things out accordingly. So, and then those grid items will have sub children and you'll have to figure that out. So
it's a fun problem for sure. Good luck. Okay. Let's see. An anonymous one from a totally anonymous, it looks like. Just asking about BEM, probably another. Why not throw this one in here? Yeah. I've been experimenting with it lately and it feels kind of right to me. I work on a small team that consists of 5 back-end devs, 2 front-end devs, including myself. I like the fact that the SAS file becomes more descriptive with a BEM methodology. Yeah, I can see that. And low specificity, right, anonymous person? Love that. Making it easier to understand someone else's code quickly. Yep, that's a big part of BEM. Another plus is, he gets to it. Another plus is low specificity. High five. Our SAS files are currently littered with important rules as a result of too much nesting, and I try not to use that unless absolutely necessary. But it seems like the downside is that you end up adding a lot more classes to the HTML. I've heard described as a new closet, stuff everything into the HTML. You know what? Mentally, I don't have a BEM product in production, but enough people, I'm just convinced by it. After reading enough about it and seeing enough of it and digesting enough of it and seeing people buy into it and like it and all that, I think I would, if I was starting a new large scale project, I would do it. I think I'd have drinking the Kool-Aid without actually doing it. I would rock the BEM.
And like, how explicit, I guess, let's say I have a module with a title and a description inside. Can you walk me?
Yeah, there's nothing to it. That's the thing about BEM. So what do you have, a module?
I have a module with a title and, or let's call it a post or something. I have a post with a title and a description. Metadata and a description.
It's like dot module is the, or dot post is the post. And then post __ title is it. You have to copy the word post twice, which is whatever, you can use SAS for that, or you can just repeat yourself or whatever. The __ meaning element, and it's namespaced, but it's not nested, you know, it's not post like space dot post title or something, you know, where now you've doubled the specificity because you're using 2 classes. It's still just 1 class. That's the part I like about it. And then, you know, you had a variation on the module or the post. It's post like --- alt or whatever. That's a variation on it. But the description would also be post __ description. And it's a little weird because, like, what's in the description? Is there, you know, a DT tag in there? Where does the image go in there? Does the image need a class too? And yeah, I would say that they do. No matter what the nesting is, just all the stuff inside of there, just do post __ because it's an element. And apply 1 class to as much stuff as you can. I guess that would be the way I use it. And like I said, I don't have any production projects using it, so I can't say exactly what the, like, you know, you can't, it would be easy to trick me on how do you do this in BEM, but I would give it a shot because my methodology now is give everything 1 well-named class, but, you know, for the most part to keep specificity low, but not have a strict methodology.
Yeah. Cause you'd be like post and dot post space dot title or something, and then somebody's going to write a dot title somewhere and ruin your dot post space dot title. So it's more being more explicit, like dot post __ title, that saves you from getting that title dot title override. Okay. I mean, yeah, I like BEM. I understand it to the degree I'm on this podcast here, but I just haven't done it, and I don't like in a project. So I have
about methodologies right now. I could use it. Like, have you employed any really strict methodology?
Not strict. I've used SMACs, or kind of like built some things around the kind of philosophy in Jonathan Snook's SMACs, which I really like. You know, his is more like you have the modules and then you have themes, you know, so like, and it's not, you know, it's not too different from the dash dash modifier in BEM. But, you know, you can be like button dash dash dark, or, you know, or primary or secondary or something. That, you know, I like that. I like, and then he also has a thing like, kind of verbs in his, at least the version I read, I don't know if it's still there, but, like is hover and is open and things like that. Which you know, there are like aria attributes and, you know, pseudo selectors that could do that. But it just sort of like you have this like mishmash of how things kind of are how state is being described. And it, you know, it makes sense to me, just like, no, this is like dot is open, you know, like, and this is when it's open. I like that. I don't know. I kind of like this, the like using verbs to kind of communicate what is currently happening or what it is at this moment.
Oh yeah. 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 Like is error, is open, is active.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like, yeah, I just, that to me gives like a little bit of a description, like an action. It's verb, it's moving, it's in a state.
And a big thing, so it's one thing to just like it, and I like it too, but you know, he's 5 back-end devs, 2 front-end devs. What if that turned into 10 back-end devs, 8 front-end devs, or something like that? This becomes more and more important. I think you don't want all 8 people just doing whatever they want. I think I shouldn't even say want, because I think people want methodology at that point. They want consistency. They want to be told, oh, how do you do it here? Okay, let's do it. I'll do it the same way so that when I look at your code, I'm not totally confused.
No, I think that's right. And you don't want, like, come up with a system either, you know, we're BEM, but we do this, you know, like, but if you have like somebody on your team who's totally not convinced and thinks it's awful, you may just have to override or like, be like, okay, come up with your thing and whiteboard it out, you know, see what happens. So, you know, cause that's the thing too, is you sometimes you get into like this flexibility thing and you're maybe not totally, you know, you're maybe too inflexible. So
yeah. Sounds good. What do we got next?
All right. Well, we got at least one more-ish, huh? Here from Polly, old man Polly. Hey, welcome back, old man Polly. I noticed that in some user profiles, developers and designers may not only work for a major company, but also have a side business of their own. We call that a side hustle.
We do.
I don't mean just freelancing on the side, but an actual company, which would include billing, paperwork, etc. I was wondering if you thought this might be an asset or problem for companies looking to hire. When hiring, I appreciate that a developer does side projects to hone their skills, but I also wonder if there might be a conflict of interest. We all know side projects can grow and take on valuable time. I was wondering if companies might see this as a problem. Thoughts? Ooh, this is a good
question. It's really good because I don't know the answer to this. In fact, somebody just recently wrote to me and said, look at my website. Like, I'm trying to get a job and I cannot get hired. I'm trying and trying. I don't get callbacks and stuff. And one of the things on their website was a bunch of side project. It wasn't a side company, but it was like, look at all this open source stuff I have. And they were billed a little bit above and beyond just like, look at my lib, you know? It was like, this is a add-on for WordPress or something. I don't even remember what they all were, but they were they had names, they had logos and stuff like that. I would say not all companies in the world, but there's some companies out there that would look at that and be like, oh, look at this guy's already got a bunch of stuff going on. Like, you ain't got time for us, you know?
I worry about this too. I sometimes, you know, it's like, oh, what happens if like Paravel goes under, belly up, you know? Oh no, I need a job. And it's like, oh, B2 Dubs, I have like 100 open source projects that drive me nuts. And then I have a podcast I got to do. And then I got to do.
Yeah, exactly.
No, yeah. But the podcast is probably the big one. It's just like, oh, by the way, I have a podcast. It takes like a couple hours a week.
It's been a while since I applied for a job, but I remember when I was getting the job at WooFoo, they straight up had to ask me. They're like, I know that CSS tricks and you're writing this book right now. And like, that's a lot of time. Do you have time for this job? And you're going to have to prove that to us. Like, first of all, you have to answer, can you answer us honestly right now? Do you have time for this for sure? And B, you know, this is provisionary at first because you need to prove that you do.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's things like that. I think there's, you know, NDA sort of stuff, like, you know, things you create here, you can't like use things you create here and like spin that off into a side business. Like it has to be separate, you know, like you need to have like those conversations. So maybe it does become harder with somebody with like a functioning side hustle. But that said, I mean, like,
the opposite seems more true, doesn't it? That if you have a bunch of like interesting work that you've produced, that goes to show that you're a good developer. And
yeah. Like, I mean, I saw, I don't want to name names, but I saw somebody who I know is working on a product very like maturely. Like it's like, I'm doing this. I was in between jobs. I started doing this and like, I like how it's going. And then I saw this weekend, they're like, oh, hey, I'm looking for work, you know? And I was just like, oh, I thought you were doing that thing, but that's okay. You know, and then they would be like an attractive hire just because it's just like, I know this is a person who does good work, you know, finishes projects, you know, does things. So, you know, I think that's a big deal. You know, I mean, I think if your profile had a bunch of baby businesses that, you know, haven't taken off or seem like they require a lot of customer support and attention, like if you have a whole WordPress theming, you know, operation on the side, like that's tough. It would seem like you're preoccupied, but for me, it would be a positive. Like I would want to talk to you, but I would also like have to have that, like, is this a problem? Like, is this too much of your time? So, or hire them, and if it becomes a problem,
that's true.
And you know, you can always.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear from companies. You know that these questions are tricky, in that we just don't know, because I'm not somebody who hires somebody who looks at resumes and says yes or no. We're just in the dark speculating on what companies might think. So go back. We did a show on hiring recently that I thought was quite good, actually. And we talked about a lot of things, but we didn't talk about this specifically, but in case any of you out there are trying to get hired, for one thing, check out the Shop Talk Show job board.
Hey, yeah. If you do a lot of hiring and you have a strong opinion, leave a comment over at on the post.
I'd love to read some posts like that. Like, these are the 10 things that I think about when looking at your resume, or here's like some obvious turnoffs that I see all the time that I see developers do, or things like that. That would be so interesting, because that would be good information to share. It's not like you're giving away the tricks of the trade. You're trying to help people be better at get jobs. You know, you think it would be a win-win kind of thing.
Oh man, could you imagine like people trying to help people get jobs though? Not many people, I don't know. I can think of like off the top of my head, like whatever, free resume coaching, you know, it's like none, you know? I don't know. Do it. Go help people get jobs, and don't just give your opinion. We have enough advice podcasts. be an expert. So no, I'm just kidding. All right, I'm done. Okay. All right, thank you everyone for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Share this show on the Twitter to talk about all the hot drama in this episode, goodness gracious. And follow us at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shopdocshow.com/jobs, because companies want to hire people like you again. Like hiring, maybe we should poll those companies. All right, we'll figure that out. All right, Chris, you got anything else?
ShopDocShow.com.